carrying on this morning with our series, What is a Christian? We've been looking at some of the words that the Bible uses to describe a true Christian. And last week we began thinking about this. A Christian is an athlete. A Christian is a runner running a race. We quoted lots of verses that talk about the Christian running a race. I'll just quote one at this point. The writer of the Hebrews says, "Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us." Now, I tried to show you last week just how important sport, especially athletics, was in the New Testament world. Many people lived for sport then, just as they do now. Sport was exciting, colourful, dramatic, thrilling. The great athletics festivals were enthralling events. And countless lads, as they grew up, dreamed of taking part one day in one of those festivals. They dreamed of running in one of the great races and of carrying off a prize. And that's the picture then that Paul and other New Testament writers take up and use. There's a race that has to be run by every Christian. And that race is far more thrilling, far more demanding than any of the races at the Olympic Games. The Christian life is the ultimate race. It demands more courage, more stamina, more determination than any sporting event. And there's infinitely more at stake. When youngsters in New Testament times came to Christ, they had to turn their back on the world of sport. I explained why last week. They had to give up their dreams of running in the races at the Olympics or at the Isthmian Games. But they still had a race to run, a far more important race, a race that's more thrilling than any sporting event that's ever taken place. They still had to be athletes, but now they were running a harder course, and they were running for a bigger prize than they'd ever dreamed of before. Let's turn first to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, the passage that we read earlier. All through this chapter, Paul is talking about his own Christian life, how he lives for Christ, how he works for Christ. And Paul talks about how hard, how demanding it is for him to live a Christian life. To work for Christ, Paul had to give up all sorts of things. Paul had to make real sacrifices. Look at some of the things that Paul lost because he followed Christ. Paul had to give up so many things that we all think of as rights. First, in verses 2 to 18, he talks about how he had to do without money. And Paul, the most brilliant and the most hard-working man around, lived on the breadline. In fact, not even that. Often Paul didn't even have enough food, enough to feed himself. He says in verse 4, "Don't we have the right to food and drink?" And then he adds in verse 5, "And don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us?" And he goes on to say that he could have demanded that other people support him financially. And he could have demanded that they support a wife for him. But no, Paul finishes up saying in verse 15, "I have not used any of these rights.
I've not claimed my right to financial support for myself, let alone for a wife. Paul had to be willing to live in poverty. He had to be willing to take any job he could get just to stay alive. He had to be willing to do without food and drink at times. He had to be willing to stay single. There were lots of reasons why Paul didn't get married, but one of the biggest was just that he had no way of supporting a wife financially. It cost Paul everything to follow Christ. His career. I mean, he was the most talented, the most brilliant scholar of his generation. He could have become the most famous, the most honored rabbi in the world, the greatest Jewish leader of all. He could have had a tremendous standard of living. He could have been wealthy and comfortable. He could have had a mansion in Jerusalem and had a holiday home in Capri. He could have been happily married and had his family around him, his children and his grandchildren. He could have had everything that this world has to offer. But instead, Paul became a tramp. He became a gypsy, always on the move, in and out of prison, beaten up by mobs, flogged, stoned, shipwrecked, hungry, thirsty, because that's what it cost him to follow Jesus Christ in obedience. Paul had to give up the right to live the way he would have chosen for himself. That's the theme of verses 19 to 23. Verse 19, though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. Paul is free. No one can tell him how he should live. Nobody can tell him what he should eat, what he should wear. He's got a right to decide those things for himself, hasn't he? And yet, Paul says, I finish up living like a slave, fitting in with what other people want, all for the sake of Christ. When Paul was with Jewish people, he follows all their little rules about hygiene and washing hands and wearing the right clothes and all those things, so that he can get alongside those Jewish people and win them for Christ. And when he's with Gentiles, well, he'll eat their disgusting food. He'll even eat pork burgers and bacon. It turns his stomach. He hates the thought of eating that food. But he'll do it, because that's the way he can tell them about Christ over their bacon breakfast. Paul will eat food that he thinks is horrible. He'll wear clothes that he'll find uncomfortable. He'll follow rules that he thinks are silly. He'll do anything in order to follow Christ, in order to do the work that Christ has given him to do. The people of the world say, I've got the right to live as I choose. It's my life. And Paul says, well, I've got the right to live as I choose, but I am never going to use that right. I'm never going to ask, what do I want? I'm going to ask, what will please Christ? What will make me a more useful servant to Christ? And then Paul sums it all up in this one sentence, verse 23. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. I do all this. I live this life of incessant hard work. I live this life of suffering and poverty. I live this life with its floggings and its stonings and its imprisonments. I live my life as a slave, choosing to eat things I would never naturally want to eat, choosing to go to places I would never naturally want to go. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, so that I may share in its blessings. It doesn't matter, says Paul, what price is involved in being a Christian and in serving Christ. All right, I often have to work till I drop. I have to do without all the nice things of life. I have to forfeit money and home comforts and even family life. I have to live like a slave, fitting in with what everybody else wants and never thinking about myself. It doesn't matter, says Paul, providing that I can share in the blessings of the gospel. The reason I do all these things is that I want the reward. And the reward is this: I'm going to receive the blessings promised in the gospel. Now, what are the blessings of the gospel that Paul talks about here in verse 23? Well, they're endless, aren't they? Forgiveness of sins. To know that my sins are blotted out. To have absolute peace of mind, knowing I'm forgiven. And then, on the day of judgment, to be accepted. To be able boldly to approach the eternal throne. To live in the presence of God forever. To live in a new universe where heaven and earth are joined. A world where there's no weeping, no sorrow, no pain, no death, no sin, no temptation. To enjoy being loved by God for all eternity. And to live in a world that's all love and nothing but love forever and ever. A world where every creature loves every other creature. To be brimful of God himself, full up to the brim with God's Spirit, joined to Christ forever, with his thoughts and his feelings flooding into me, sharing his everlasting happiness as it overflows into me. Those are the blessings of the gospel. And Paul says, I'll do anything to get them. I know I can't have these blessings unless I follow Christ and unless I serve Christ here in this world. And I'm going to do it. If these are the rewards that are on offer, if these blessings are there to be had, I don't care what it costs. I'm going to live for Christ, says Paul. I'm going to serve him with all my energy. I'm going to work for him and please him and obey him however hard his commands may be. I'm going to make every effort. I'm going to do whatever it costs. I'll do all this, whatever it may be, for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. And then Paul turns to his readers and says, and so must you. You must live your Christian lives with just the same single-mindedness, just the same determination that I do. If you want the blessings of the gospel here in this world and then forever in heaven, you're going to have to live just the same way that I do, says Paul, because there's no other way of winning them. He launches into this picture in verses 24 onwards, a picture they all understand, the picture of the games. And the whole point that he presses home to his readers is this: that the Christian life is a race. in which we are running for a great prize. And nobody is going to win that prize unless they go for it with all their might. I want to sum up Paul's teaching here and in other passages under three headings. And then I want to add a fourth lesson from another New Testament writer. Lesson one, we run for a prize. We run for a prize. That's so clear here, isn't it? Verse 24, don't you know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Think about the life of an athlete or any top sportsman. Imagine a girl of 10 or 11 at school who seems to be gifted at athletics. So she joins a club and she starts entering competitions. And it becomes clear that she's really got what it takes. And she begins to dream that one day she'll reach the top. One day she'll go to the Olympics and win a medal. She's looking already 10 years ahead. And now for the next 10 years, her life is going to be dominated by preparing for that race 10 years ahead. Every evening she's down in the gym, or she's on the track. Her friends are out enjoying themselves at the disco, or they're just hanging about, or they're at home watching TV. But that's not for her. She's got no time to spare. She's got no time for TV or boyfriends or just messing about or anything else. Once her homework's done, she's down to the track, just pounding away hour after hour, practicing sprint starts or practicing hurdling technique or whatever it is. Other girls just eat what they want. They can go out to McDonald's and they can shove down the Big Macs and the Cokes and everything else. But she can't touch them. For 10 years she's going to forfeit all that because she's on a strict diet. She's got to have stamina without carrying any excess weight. Her life is one long regime of self-discipline, self-denial, hard work, dedication. So what keeps her going? What motivates her? It's this, the thought of the reward. The thought that one day she'll stand on the podium and she'll wear the medal round her neck. That's what keeps her going. Through the endless hours of dogged training, when she feels so lonely because she's left out of all the things her friends are doing. What keeps her going? It's the thought of the reward. She'll make endless sacrifices for the sake of the reward. And yet, what is her reward? A moment of triumph. A piece of metal to hang round her neck for 5 minutes. And then to be stuck in a glass case. A handshake from some minor royalty. An entry maybe in the Guinness Book of Sporting Records. And that's it. That's her reward. And yet she thinks it worthwhile. For the sake of that reward, she'll keep going. She'll keep going through all the years of pain and sacrifice in order to win that one moment of triumph. She's willing to make any sacrifice. Well, if you're going to run the Christian race, if you're going to keep obeying when the way is hard, if you're going to keep on doing things that are exhausting and painful and often lonely, then you need motivation. And the motivation is that there is a wonderful reward for those who complete this race. And the reward is not just a moment of triumph, which is over and gone. The reward is an everlasting reward. You see in verse 25, they do it to get a crown that won't last. But we do it to get a crown that will last forever. A crown that will last forever. He's not talking about a king's crown. He's talking about the garland that a winner in the games was given. Now we have a medal instead. You're going to stand before Christ, the King of Kings, on the day of judgment. And he's going to put the crown on your head. He's going to hang the medal round your neck. He's going to say to you, "Well done, well run, you've won." And millions of believers who ran the race before you, they are going to burst into shouting and clapping because you've won your race. And billions of angels and archangels, cherubim and seraphim, are going to join in the applause. It'll ring to the furthest corners of heaven. And you're going to step into glory. You're going to share Christ's everlasting glory. You're going to sit down at a banquet that will last forever. You're going to enter into a joy that will never fade. You're going to have the friendship of the eternal God. You're going to have a place in the palace of the King. These are the rewards that are there waiting for you at the end of the track. And you've got to remind yourself of those things. When the Christian life seems agonizingly hard, or when it just seems drab and boring and uneventful, because the Christian race is often like that, you've got to be reminding yourself again and again and again just how huge the reward is to see him, to see Christ. His face was spat on and covered with blood for you, and contorted with pain. But you're going to see his face light up with joy. Because you finished your race for him, that's going to fill him with delight. You're going to see his face filled with ecstatic delight. Because you finished your race. And you're going to feel his kiss on your cheek. And you're going to feel the strong arms of the King of Kings, the Holy One, around you. And he's going to strip off the grimy, sweaty, sin-soaked gear in which you ran your race. He's going to wash away the dust of this world from you. And he's going to dress you in garments of white. And he's going to lead you to a place where you'll sit at his right hand in his great banqueting hall. Those are your rewards. It's worth training 50 years. It's worth running through rain and hail and mud and blisters to win that reward. Some Christians, you know, shrink away from the idea of rewards. They say, well, we shouldn't be motivated by rewards. They say, you know, isn't it selfish to do things for a reward? Well, they're flying in the face of the Bible, aren't they? Because the Bible so often says that we must set out to win rewards. If they were right, Paul would have said, run just for the joy of running. Don't worry about whether you get a crown in the end or not. But Paul doesn't say that. Paul says we must run to win the crown. He says that is to be our motive. Is it selfish to win rewards or to seek rewards? Well, it depends what the reward is, doesn't it? Think about two men who both want to marry the same woman. One wants to marry her because she's rich and he wants her money. That's the reward he's looking for. That's why he courts her so assiduously. Oh, we'd say that was selfish, wouldn't we? We'd say that was wrong. but the other man actually loves her. And he wants to be loved by her. And he wants to care for her and protect her and make her happy. And that's the reward he wants. And that's why he courts her so long and so assiduously. Well, isn't that right? Isn't that honorable? Isn't that lovely? That he should have that reward in view? The reward we're looking for is Christ himself. We want to please him. We want to bring him honor. We want to share his likeness. To shine out his holiness forever. We want to be close to him for all eternity. We want to enjoy his love, which never ends. We want to be free from the sins that grieve him. We want to serve him in his palace eternally. That's our reward. That's our crown. And if you love Christ at all, it's the hope of winning that crown that keeps you going through everything. So the first lesson is this. We run for a prize, for a reward, for a crown. And then the second lesson is this. We must finish the course. We must finish the course. Paul points out in verse 24 that in any race there are people who don't win. In fact, in the great sporting events, there's usually only one who does win. In a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize. And that's not true in the Christian life. But it's certainly true that there are many people who set out to run the race and never finish the course. They never win the prize. They're disqualified, or they drop out. They never get to heaven. They never win the crown of life. And Paul is aware that that could happen to him. You see, he says in verse 27, I beat my body, I make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. You see the picture? Paul has been a Christian many years now. He's been a Christian leader, a Christian worker. He's preached to others, he says. He's had tremendous spiritual experiences and seen huge blessing on his work. Thousands of people have been converted through him. Well, you might think Paul would be saying now, well, at least I know I'm not going to fail at this stage. Having got thus far, I'm sure I'm not going to lose out on the prize now. Surely at this stage in his Christian life, surely Paul can stop worrying about whether he's going to get there or not. Surely Paul can take things a bit easier now. He's past the hard stage, hasn't he? But no, Paul says, I could still be disqualified for the prize. I could still trip up and fall and not get back on my feet. I could still wander off the track and be disqualified. I have to be just as determined, just as single-minded now as I was at the beginning. I still have to beat my body, says Paul. He's not saying he's like a monk beating himself with a little whip. He's saying he's like an athlete in training who forces his body to do things he doesn't want to do. He says he makes his body his slave. After all these years, Paul has been a Christian. His body still doesn't want to get out of bed in the morning to pray, but he forces it to. His body still doesn't want to start walking to the Bible study, but he makes it. It's as hard for Paul now as it was when he was first converted. that is harder. It's just as hard now to live a Christian life and to make himself do the things he ought to do as it ever was. But Paul is still forcing himself because he knows that if he doesn't, he could finish up dropping out of the race. He could finish up being disqualified. He's got to run that race all the way to the finishing line. I remember hearing a story years ago about a marathon runner. Told it was a true story, but I can't vouch for it. I don't know the name of the runner, I don't know the year. But I've never been able to get the story out of my head. Perhaps somebody will be able to tell me who the character was. Apparently this runner ran the whole grueling length of the race. The whole marathon. He was out ahead all the way, 26 miles and however. Still going. He was exhausted, stumbling along, but at least everybody was sure he was going to win. It was a certainty here. He was so far ahead of the other competitors. And he's into the final 100 yards. He's into the final 50 yards. He's into the final 10 yards. The final 5 yards. And he stumbles. And his supporters rush forward. And they drag him across the line. And he's lost the race. He's disqualified. With 5 yards to go. He only had to keep going another 5 yards. But he's lost. And it happens. It happens in the Christian race. There are men and women who run well for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. They're experienced Christians. They're hard-working pillars in the church. They're leaders. They've remained faithful and they're into the final stage. And suddenly they're out of the race. They fall into great sins. They abandon the Christian faith. They turn their back on the church and its fellowship. They go back into the world. I've seen it happen. I've seen a man, a pastor, for many years, who in his late 60s suddenly declares himself to be a homosexual and turns his back on gospel Christianity. It happens. Paul is fearful. Paul says, I know I could still be disqualified. I'm not taking it for granted. Even now I'm going to finish the race. Why does it happen? Why is it that people who have run well over many years fall at the last hurdle? Well, it's because they've forgotten this. When they were young Christians, they knew they had to discipline themselves. They knew they couldn't afford to take things easy. They knew they had to make sacrifices to follow Christ. They knew they couldn't play with any temptation. When they were young Christians, they put out of their life ruthlessly anything that made them soft. But as the years went by, they lost their edge. And they started taking things comfortably. And they decided they didn't need to be so extreme, so over the top in their Christianity as they were years earlier. They decided they were entitled to sit back a little now. After all, as far as they were concerned, they were way out front in the race. They can coast now. Nothing can go very wrong now, can it? You can't afford to think like that at any stage in the Christian race. You've got to keep running, and you've got to keep running, and you've got to keep running. And when you're tempted to take things a bit easy, you say to yourself, I could still lose this prize. And you press on. And then the third lesson follows on naturally.
And it's this. To win this race, we'll need total determination and single-mindedness. Nobody wins this race just by jogging along, doing as little as they can get away with. Paul says, I don't run like a man running aimlessly. That's verse 26. A man just jogs along the beach at his own pace, enjoying the scenery, just running aimlessly. Paul says, I don't run that way. And then he says, I don't fight like a man beating the air. I'm not just a shadow boxer involved in an imaginary contest against imaginary enemies in a fight that I can't lose. I'm involved in a real race. I'm involved in a real fight against real opponents who will knock me down, who will knock me out if I don't fight with all my strength. I know that to win is going to take everything I've got. It's going to take self-control and discipline, forcing myself to do things I don't want to do, forcing myself to do without things that I naturally want, forcing myself to study when I want to relax, forcing myself to meetings when I'd rather stay at home, forcing myself to pray when I'd rather sleep, forcing myself to talk to other people when I'd rather hide away, forcing myself to work when I'd rather rest, forcing myself to open my mouth and sing when I'd rather stand there daydreaming, forcing myself to praise when I'd rather just mope and feel sorry for myself. The cost of being an athlete is that you force yourself all the time to do things that you don't feel like doing. It's going to take exertion. It's going to take hard work. An athlete who runs his race with all his determination is going to be exhausted. He's going to collapse once he's finished, crossed the finishing line. We talked about hard worker in the Christian life when we looked at the word servant, do you remember? But it's here again in the word athlete, isn't it? Competing in any serious sporting event is hard work. And it's going to take sacrifice. It's going to mean getting rid of things, anything, that makes it harder for us to compete. Perhaps this comes out most clearly in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Do you see, the writer says that to run this race, you've got to throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Well, the second bit perhaps is obvious. He says we've got to get rid of sins. Sins that tangle us up, that stop us from running properly. There are things that are plainly sinful. And if you try to hang on to them, they'll tangle you and they'll trip you and you'll never finish the race. If you carry on looking at those dirty magazines, it will destroy you as a Christian. If you carry on that quarrel and refuse to sort it out, it'll drag you down and your Christian life will become more and more unreal and you'll never win the prize. If you carry on that sinful relationship which God has forbidden, then there'll be no heavenly rewards for you. There'll only be the outer darkness. Yes, we've got to get rid of the sins that entangle, he says. But the writer doesn't only say that you've got to get rid of the things that are obviously sinful. He says you've got to throw off everything that hinders. In the Greek games, you know, the athletes ran naked. They stripped off literally everything that could possibly hinder. Modern athletes don't do that, but they wear the barest minimum. They know they can't afford to carry an unnecessary ounce. Well, the writer says to run the Christian race, you're going to have to get rid not only of things that are sinful, you're going to have to get rid of anything and everything that slows you down. Anything that stops you from being everything you could be. And that can mean anything from computer games to gardening to Banner of Truth books. There are plenty of people who would be better Christians, who would live closer to Christ, if they spend less time collecting theological books and more time seeking for Christ himself. You look at every single thing in your life and you say, does this help me to love Christ? Does this actually help me to serve Christ? Or is it just a drag? Does it slow me down? Can you imagine an athlete turning up for his event at the Olympics? And he's at his place, at the starting blocks. And all the other runners are in vests and shorts. But this man is wearing a three-piece suit. And an overcoat. You see, after all, he might need it. It might get cold during the afternoon. You never know when you need an overcoat. And he's carrying an open umbrella. Because after all, it might turn to rain and he can't afford to get wet. It might give him a cold. And he's brought along a book so that he can read it at any boring moments during the race. And he's got a packed lunch in case he gets hungry. And a radio to listen to the news as he runs. And his photo album so that he can look at photos of his wife and his children along the way. You think that's stupid? And yet millions of Christians are trying to run the Christian life carrying endless unnecessary baggage. You just feel so sorry for them. They think they've got it made because they've got all these wonderful things in this world. They've got all these lovely possessions to look after, i.e. to take up their time and energy. And they've got all these wonderful hobbies to fill in their spare time. They've got all these things. And you look at them and you just say, oh, what an idiot. Trying to run the Christian life, carrying all that unnecessary baggage, with all those distractions. What's he think he's doing? So many things in our lives that just take up our time and energy and stop us from praying, that stop us from working for Christ, that stop us from giving ourselves to the life of the church, that stop us from being single-minded Christians. Why don't we get rid of them? It's just so tragic, so stupid. Christians trying to run the most demanding race in the world, carrying all their knick-knacks with them. You just want to tear these things away from them and say, look, you'd be so much happier without them. Take off that overcoat. Throw away that umbrella and run the race. We're not going to win the race cluttered with a million unnecessary things. To win this race needs total determination. It needs complete, undistracted single-mindedness. And then the fourth lesson, very briefly, though it's the most important of all. It's here in Hebrews chapter 12. The writer says, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. And let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Fourth lesson is this: we run our race with our eyes fixed on Jesus, who has run it before us. He is the great forerunner. He has run this race before us. He endured the cross. He scorned its shame. He endured the humiliation as well as the pain. And now he's completed his race. And he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. He's entered into glory and everlasting joy. He ran this race for a reward. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. And now he's receiving that reward. There is nothing that will encourage us more during those times when the race seems long, during the times when the race seems exhausting, during those times when it just seems that every physical and spiritual muscle is aching, during those times when we feel we can't run another step, there's nothing that will encourage us more, nothing that will put new strength into us like the thought of Christ, the thought of the Saviour running his lonely race, running through years of obedient service, running through tears, running through agonies of fear, running through the humiliation and the torment of the cross, running onwards to glory, and the knowledge that that's where he is now, and that that's where our race will end. We run this race with our eyes fixed on Jesus, who has run it before us. The Christian is an athlete. When you became a Christian, when you professed faith in the Lord Jesus, when you were baptized, you started a race. Will you complete it? This morning I mentioned John Marshall. Just the joy of knowing that he's finished his course. All those years. 40 odd years was it? Pastoring one congregation, preaching in the open air, serving Christ with all his energies. He's done it. He did it by fixing his eyes on Jesus. You have the same resources that he had. The same Saviour, the same Holy Spirit, the same book to guide you, and the same race to run. Will you complete your course with joy? Will you come safely to glory? May God speak to us through his holy and perfect word.